Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. My name is Kieran Tavam, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host based out in the United States, JJ Duke. JJ, how are you, mate?
Good. Good to be back. Seems like we've done a lot of these over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's been busy, hasn't it? Obviously, lots of content going up on the website, a few podcasts here and there. Obviously, we were joined by Anno Dong and Linda Eriksson for our last podcast, looking back at the Euro 2017 group stages. This podcast is to really look back at the final and to look back at the tournament as a whole. So let's dive straight in, mate. You know, no need for breaks, no need for any more chit-chat or general banter. The final itself was, of course, won by the host, the Netherlands. They are the first host to win the European Championship since Germany in 2001. When you look at the predictions in our Euro 2017 guide, which we produced just before the tournament, JJ, none of our experts, and I don't think even us, had the Netherlands to win. They came out 4-2 winners over Denmark. They won every single game in the competition, didn't need extra time, didn't need penalty kicks. They were the worthy winners, and they were superb throughout, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they just built on momentum throughout the tournament. I know you saw them in their opening match, all the way 3.5 weeks ago or something along those lines. And it just seemed like they got better and better, felt more confident in themselves. And it always helps to have that 12th player behind you, that being the crowd. I mean, they drew big numbers wherever they went throughout this tournament. I think that's an intangible that sometimes people don't really think about too much. They think, okay, sure, the home crowd is there, great. But they fed off of it. I mean, you could see at times, I love Shanice van de Sanden, who would always, which she got subbed off regularly for some reason, always kept like putting her ears up and saying, come on, bring it, bring it. I think players enjoyed that. And, you know, their play on the field was just as brilliant as the support was off the field. I think that they continue to do what they do. And they scored goals as well, which I've said in the last podcast, it feels like this tournament, even though the goal scoring as a collective was down, I felt like the attacking was just better than ones in years past.
Yeah, none better than the Dutch, was there. You know, that front three of Shanice van de Sanden, Viviane Miedema and Lieke Martins, who of course won the player of the tournament. They were frightening right from minute one in the first game, right through to the 90th minute in the last. They linked up superbly. Head coach Serena Wiegman pretty much kept the same team throughout the whole tournament with a few tweaks here and there. And you could see that consistency paid off. I think what I find most impressive is that by keeping that same team and with the short periods in between each game, the Dutch never seemed to lose any kind of fitness or never seemed to look tired, despite the fact that they pretty much played the same team from start to finish.
No, you're right. And I think it bodes well to the amount of time that they had to prepare for this tournament. I mean, you know, we talked about it in the past where they didn't have any competitive matches for a year, but they already had, you know, the knowledge that they were going to be in the tournament. So they really worked hard on what their system was going to be. It seemed like they knew what their team was going to be a long time before this tournament. They played some key friendlies, but with that being said, yeah, you look up and down this tournament, and I had some questions about how some of the scheduling went where, teams in Group D, which was the England and Spain group, they had, what, maybe 2 full days to recover before the first knockout group, whereas the Netherlands had pretty much almost a week to recover prior to their first knockout game. Though then, with that being said, there's the quick turnaround between the semis and the finals. But yeah, you're right. Fitness was never an issue. Team spirit was always high, and I think adrenaline, that helps a little bit. And obviously, when you're making a run into the tournament, you kind of forget about those weary legs and you're just looking, you know, ahead to the next goal and the next stage. And for them, that was winning the final.
Yeah, and you talk about adrenaline. I think a lot of that will have been fed off of the crowd and the interest that came from the local people. As I said, I was out from the semi-final stages through to the final. I went out early on for the opening game, came home and covered the tournament from here, but then went back out and I went out to Enschede, JJ, where the semi-final between the Netherlands and England took place, and obviously the final was there as well. Mate, I said it on social media, I've never seen anything like it. The Dutch people were absolutely crazy. They have completely been drawn in by this women's team, by the success that they've had on the field. There were orange shirts absolutely everywhere in Enschede. The fan walk that took place from the city centre to the stadium, which is about 5 kilometres away, stretched back for at least 2 or 3 kilometres. The dancing outside the stadium was crazy. People will have seen that on social media. And then the atmosphere in the ground for both the semi-final and the final was electric. And I don't think as players you can do anything but feed off of that. Yes, there might be an element of pressure that you feel because of that expectation that comes with getting so far. But because people hadn't really expected the Dutch to maybe get beyond the quarterfinals, maybe even the semis, I think they were just riding a crest of a wave. And whatever happened, they were always going to be, I think, well supported because of how they performed. It wasn't just the victories, it was how they were winning as well.
Agreed 100%. And I think it's a two-prong here with that. You have to give big credit to the organizers of this tournament, because not only was just the Netherlands match as well attended, I can only really count on one hand where there was, you know, not a stadium less than two-thirds full the entire time. Obviously, some of the venues were a little bit smaller than others, but still felt like the crowds as a whole were pretty boisterous. They're pretty passionate. They seem to enjoy the competition. And obviously, that also helps when you have the home side doing well. So it is that two-prong. And you're right, the players, they, you know, we may never know truly what their goals were as a team that they set out for this tournament, but they never look like they're fearful of the moment. And I think that's a prime success. And you and I talked about it in major tournaments in the past where big players, the United States, Germany, they tend to succeed at these moments because they've been there before and they're not afraid of it. You have to give credit to the Netherlands because they've never been here before, but yet they look the part. And I think that's always going to be the thing that will stand out for them at the end of the day. They look like they were supposed to be there. They played and acted like they're supposed to be there, and then they won.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with that. I will stress that obviously their opponents had never been in that position either in Denmark. And we should talk about them. Obviously, it takes two teams to make a final, and it certainly makes two teams to make as entertaining a final as we were treated to. And after 45 minutes, we went in at half time at 2 apiece. Obviously, the Danes took the lead. And I think it would be better coming from you, mate. Talk about the significance of Nadia Nadim scoring in that final, because the journey that woman has been on and where she's come to now from where she's been during her life and during her career, that is pretty special for anyone. Doesn't matter if you're Danish, doesn't matter if you're from Afghanistan, but that was special for anyone that follows women's football.
Yeah, you know, this story, I've actually had an opportunity to follow this a bit before a lot of people knew who she really was. You know, a good friend of mine and former editor-in-chief of Our Game magazine, Tiffany Weimer, played with Nadia over Fortuna Huring back, this was what, the 2012 season and 2013 as well. And she was a player that was starting to find the peak at that time. And I really got to understand her story as Tiff did a piece on her for one of the issues of that 2013 calendar year. And you really started to appreciate what this woman has been through in her still, mate, we have to remember this, still very young life, as she is, you know, still shy of 30 years old and has had to, you know, had to flee Afghanistan, was in Denmark in asylum, holding out there, hoping that, you know, they would be able to gain citizenship as a family. They did that, then started to play football, also had medical school opportunities as well, then gains more experience by coming here to the United States. And it's a roller coaster story that's worthy of a movie script. Probably could very well be one that could be made in the coming years, but she has played the part. She is energetic. I had a great chance to see her on a couple of occasions play when she was at Sky Blue, and a fierce competitor on the field, but off the field, a smile on her face all the time. Just always so happy to be doing what she is doing. And you're right, I think that was the moment to remember for her to be scoring in that final so early on. And that was the lift that Denmark needed, because over the past or the few matches leading up to it, the goals really weren't coming for them, but they got on the board early, and, you know, they made it one great final.
Yeah, and of course she scored against Germany, didn't she, in the quarterfinals as well. So, you know, very, very special for her. And I think anyone that would think badly of her for any reason, I think that I don't think there's going to be many people that are around. I think even the Dutch will appreciate the story that she's had, and there will be few that would begrudge her that moment that she had in that final. But I think Denmark, you know, they were more than just Nadia Nadine. I think Pernille Harder, 24 years old and wearing the captain's armband, I thought she was absolutely superb throughout the whole competition and proved once again why she is one of the best players in the world. And they had some really difficult situations, Denmark. They suffered injuries during the competition. They had to play Stina Larsson, who is more well known for her attacking play, started the first game against Belgium up front alongside Nadia Nadim. She played the rest of the competition at centre back after the team suffered some injuries, so you have to give her credit for slotting in and doing a job. And much like the Dutch, mate, you know, in Enschede, yes, they were very much outnumbered, but there were a lot of Danes that had made the journey over. And actually, we're going to play some audio from some Danish fans that were in Enschede. And believe me, when you hear what they've got to say, you really get an idea of how the Danish team, much like the Dutch, have encapsulated the interest back at home. But, you know, I think it's easy for us to talk about the final, but I did manage to get some audio from the mix zone after the game. So we'll hear from first Danielle van der Donk, who of course plays for Arsenal. She was superb during the tournament. I must say her midfield partners, Sherida Spitzer and Jackie Gronen, were equally as good. Jackie Gronen probably a little bit unlucky not to win the player of the tournament, although it'd be very, very difficult to disagree with Lieke Martins. So we'll hear from Danielle, and then we're going to hear from centre-back Anouk Dekker, and then we'll hear some reaction from the losing side, Katrina Veya. Fair play to her. She came out to speak to the media, so we'll hear from her as well. So here's the three players back-to-back.
It feels amazing. I got no words for it. I can't describe it. It's a bit unreal, to be fair, but it just helps kind of be more real in a couple of days.
How would you describe the game? It was fast-paced. There was a lot of goals, a lot of back and
forth.
Yeah,
that was a bit weird for a final, wasn't it? Yeah, it was the first half. It was a bit, like, nervous. I don't think we got, like, they scored first. And then, yeah, we need to step up our game. And we didn't have that before in the tournament. So it was a bit different. The environment changed a bit in the team. But we stepped up again. And I don't know, like, we got loads of good players that could score. So, yeah, I'm busy now.
How much more special does it feel, Daniel, winning it in your home country? It's not just the first major tournament for Holland, but to win it in front of your fans.
Yeah, that is amazing. I've never expected that we win it. So that we did, it was just, it's like plus, actually, in front of everyone of our own countries. Just amazing, like the people are like so positive, we wouldn't expect it before. So yeah, I just can't, I don't know, I'm just really happy. I'm happy that, like, it's the next step for the football for women in the Netherlands.
How much are you aware of kind of the fans and how they've been following you on this tournament? Because I'm sure you try and zone out, you try and focus on the football, but
yeah,
the scenes, the sea of orange, the bouncing around, the dancing, this is something completely unknown to women's football in Holland.
Yeah, that's true. I've completely locked myself out of the social media and stuff, because it was so big, like, I can't describe it really, and I thought it was going to make myself a bit more nervous. But every time I got in the stadium, they just give me energy, and I'm just going to hope and pray they're going to be there every time now.
Have you read anything in the newspapers? Is that surreal seeing your face?
No, I haven't. Actually, I didn't want to, because I've got the World Cup and the Euros before it, and I read a couple of things, and it really scared me a bit. It wasn't not even about me, it was about Phoebe and Amida, my other girls. But I've seen they got so much pressure off it, I was like, I'm not gonna do it this time. And I didn't, and it felt better.
Got to ask, because some of us are English-based, you obviously, the team has got a few players are playing the FAWSL. How much of a benefit has the development there helped with
definitely.
Some of the players here?
Yeah, like, we got a couple of girls playing in Germany, in Sweden, in England, like, all over the country, world, I mean. I think that's been a great benefit to our development of the national team, and I hope it's just going to be more and more. Everyone's going to come to England now.
What's it been like for you when you've seen all the fans bouncing around outside the stadium?
Goosebumps everywhere, and I get a smile on my face that I saw them walking to the stadium, and that we can show how good we are to them. And yeah, it's so amazing.
And it's so different, isn't it, from 8 years ago when Holland got to the semi-finals of the Euros. I mean, it was, the game has come so far, hasn't it? And to see the stadium today, the stadium against England on Thursday, I mean, it must be great for you guys looking forward as well.
Yeah, when I saw the semi-final and the final was here in this stadium, I wanted to do everything to play here. And you see the crowd is amazing. And we developed the style of soccer, and I think we have a great team and we play great soccer. And I hope we can continue that.
Did it help that you played here on Thursday in front of a big crowd? Maybe it didn't have the pressure that maybe Denmark had?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, but it helped us. And I want to say thank you to all the supporters for us.
What's the plan for tonight?
We've got to have a party. I don't think I can sing because my voice is gone, but we're going to have a party.
Think Holland equalising straight after you took the lead in the first half was crucial in that game?
Yeah, we made a good goal on the penalty, and I think we played a good first half. The second half we could feel in the legs that we have been played 120 minutes against Austria, so for sure we could feel that. And the Netherlands were just better today.
And you personally had a great first half, we think. You attacking, done wing every opportunity. Was that the plan from yours?
The plan from Nils was that we have to go high in the first half. We have to just keep going and running and running, and we did that, and we have a lot of chances. So, yeah, it was a shame that we didn't, just win the game.
How proud are you, Katrin, of the performance of your team? Very few people, if any, would have predicted you to get this far in the competition. I mean, you've given a good account of yourselves today, haven't you? How proud are you of your teammates?
Yeah, for sure, we're proud of the teammates. I'm very proud. I think we now have to be sad. I think that's okay. And then tomorrow we will be proud when we land in Denmark again, and we will be proud of this medal.
What do you think it will mean for women's football back in Denmark? Nils was speaking very passionately yesterday in his press conference about respect for women's football. How much respect and how much is it going to mean back home?
Yeah, I hope this is a turning. It's not like that, just get in the final. So for sure, I hope we get a lot of respect, we already do. But right now we're just in the bubble here. So we will feel it for sure when we land in Denmark.
So that was Daniel van der Donk, Anouk Dekker and Katrine Veyer. JJ, one of the big questions that always arises after a major tournament is, how do you keep that interest? The numbers have been hugely impressive. I can tell you the audience numbers game on game were bigger in England on broadcast television. In the Netherlands during the final, 5.4 million people watched that game against Denmark, which accounts for about 30% of the population. The big thing now, not just for Holland, not just for Denmark, not just for England, is those players have showcased their talents. There's clearly been some interest, but how do you keep that momentum going?
Well, not to bring this into a full winding story, because there are many elements that you can do to keep the attention on you. But to kind of put it simply, each of the leagues domestically for all these countries that participate in the Euros has to capture that, you know, the passion that was there for their national team. And not to say remind the support groups, because as we know, women's football support is a tight-knit group. It's definitely expanding, and it has expanded very well over the past decade or so, but there can always be more to be done. So it's clubs reminding the fans, hey, look, you know, you enjoyed Nation X in the Euros. Well, these teams showcase players Y and Z, so make sure to come out and see them on a week-to-week basis. You're talking about television audiences and obviously streaming partners. You know, maybe the interest and the numbers that they gained throughout this tournament would help carry that forward into perhaps league deals. I think that would be a big plus for that. So those are two definite ways that you can gain exposure and kind of carry it forward. But I think the big one for me, and this goes a little bit beyond the picture of just the players and the teams themselves, but this tournament showcased that it's not just the same traditional markets that are having success. We have more and more teams that are not only competing just at the stage, but having success at the stage. We had five debutante countries in this Euros. All five of them won at least one match during this tournament. So they're not just showing up for showing up's sake. They're going out and winning and, you know, trying to build on the success that they have. And, you know, World Cup qualifying's coming right around the corner. So if you can combine all that and have all these new markets really get on the pedal with this and just push on forward, then yeah, I think that there's a real possibility of some of these nations gaining off of this and, you know, going to heights that maybe we couldn't have imagined 5 years ago.
Yeah. And I find it difficult to disagree. I think you've gone for the very best out, you know, best scenario, best outcome and what should be done. I'm maybe a little bit more cautious because I've seen this before when England have done well. In 2015, we saw them win a bronze medal at the World Cup. You kind of had people saying this is going to be the boom that English football needs. And while the national team has continued to do well, attendances in the FAWSL are okay. You know, I'm not going to start slagging off clubs, and that I know that they're doing everything that they can, but you can have 5.4 million people in Holland watching the final. You can have 4.2 million people in England watching the semi-final against the Netherlands. Now you need to figure out how you transition those numbers into bums on seats in stadiums. And it's very, very difficult. 2012 Olympics, Team GB, you know, they inspired a nation of young people who were interested in women's football, beat Brazil at Wembley in front of 70,000 people. There was no real boost after beyond maybe 3 or 6 months in terms of attendance numbers. So I'm slightly more cautious. I do think that the associations have a hugely difficult job. But what I did do after the game between the Netherlands and the Danes, I did speak to a few fans to kind of get an insight from them as to what it meant for their nations to be in the final. So I spoke to two fans and I didn't get their ages, but I can just say that they were from different generations. One fan that was maybe a little bit older, one fan that was a little bit younger. And I wanted to get their perceptions of what the Dutch victory meant. And then after that, you will hear from a Danish fan. I tell you what, mate, he was absolutely class. He rocked up to the final in a big Viking helmet. He had a Danish flag painted on his face. He was there with what I'm assuming. Yeah, it was badass, mate. I will post the picture. In fact, I did post a picture on social media. It's on my Twitter account at Kiers Tavum. It was absolutely classic. So I wanted to grab him and kind of get an insight from him. And I tell you what, his answer was really interesting. So I'll play the first fans. They are both from Holland. And then straight after that, it will be the Danish fan who was the guy dressed up as a Viking who looked absolutely superb. So here they are.
It's a historical day because we never won the Europe Cup, of course. And it's also historical because the women's football in the Netherlands is not so much developed as in other countries.
So how long have you followed women's football in Holland? How many years, how many months?
I played football self for 40 years. So since, I think, 1980, I'm following the developments.
And how important is winning this competition for people to recognise women's football in Holland?
Yeah, I hope this will finally open the eyes of people that the women's football is a serious sport and the women can serious play good football.
And be honest with me, when the tournament started, did you really think Holland could win?
No, never. No. Because I didn't think that the Dutch team was so good as they appear to be. And when they won from Norway, then I thought, maybe there's going to be a nice thing.
And who were the players in the Holland team that impressed you?
For me, the big favourite is Jackie Groenen. Jackie Groenen is my favourite.
Why?
Because she is she's not so big, but she is so fast and such a big technique. She is my favourite. And of course, we have Lieke Martens. We cannot miss her in the team, but my favourite is Jackie Groenen.
What it means today for the Dutch women's team to have won this European competition?
A lot. I think that the national team they dreamed of it, but they didn't think they really going to do it. But maybe, yeah, it's really big for them, but for the whole basketball industry for a woman, it's huge.
So how long have you followed women's football in Holland?
I play, when I was four, I played football. And after that I go, and now I stopped last year, but I play all my life.
So do you follow a team? Do you follow any Dutch team or
yes,
a
yes.
team abroad?
Yes, I follow the Dutch team, but also the higher football in the Netherlands, like the Eredivisie, like ADO, Ajax, the big teams. And I played also in a higher team.
When did you start to believe that the Netherlands could win this competition? When was it that you thought we actually have a chance?
After the first game.
After the Norway game?
Yes, yes.
Why?
It was a very high level of football. They played before in 2009, they get to the half final, but this time it was different. This time it was good football, high quality, it was very good. So.
And which players impressed you during this tournament? Which players did you like? Who played well?
Jackie Groene.
Why?
By far the most important player in the team. Why? Because she was very important for the defense, but also for the attack. So it was very good.
You said this is huge for women's football in Holland.
Yeah.
What's your hope? What do you hope will happen now that you've won this competition and the players have you've been on the front of newspapers, you've been on television? What's the hope now that you have for this Dutch team and for women's football in Holland?
More sponsoring, so they get all the clubs get more money, and they and the level of football in the Netherlands will grow and will be better.
That's very important because that's the first time the Danish women have been. But that's the first time we have been so high up in the league.
Have you followed women's football in Denmark very much, or you came out for this game particularly?
We came for this game particularly. Yes, we have been.
Why?
We have been watching two games before, and so we start to interest for the Danish women. Say, hey, they're good. So that's why we drive 800 kilometers down here to see the match.
Why did you feel it was important to come and support the women?
For the experience, just to have fun, yeah, and be a part of it.
And did you, other than the result, did you get everything that you wanted from today? Did you get that experience? Did you get that fun?
Yeah, I think so. It was a great experience on the stadium. We have never tried it before. It was great amongst Dutch people. There were not many Danish in our group.
Do you follow the men's team as well?
No, we don't do.
You don't follow the men?
No, we don't do.
We're not that interested in football at all.
So you're not that interested in football, but you really wanted to come and experience.
We just thought that was amazing. The women went this far, and then we just wanted to come and watch the game.
So big thanks there to those fans. JJ, I know that you haven't heard them, but what was really interesting, especially from the Danish fan, was that he and his partner, they flew out to the Netherlands especially for that final. They had no interest in women's football. They had no interest in men's football. And yet they had really been inspired by the performance of the women in the Danish team. And they flew out especially for that game. And those are the people, if you engage them, and you keep them interested, they can be the ones that are turning up to stadiums week in, week out, potentially in the domestic competitions.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think the one element that I've always enjoyed in covering women's sport, and this goes beyond just football, the ability that players have to connect with their fans is something that's unique and something that I think that the players cherish in doing. I mean, you almost every stadium here, whether it's professional level or semi-pro or collegiate stateside, you almost have autographs being signed after every game, young fans that are wanting to come up. And, you know, these are things that, again, it's all about the marketing going forward. How are teams going to connect with those fans and continue to bring them back and add to it. And yeah, you mentioned before that these are the struggles that teams will have. And I think in England, the one big change this year will be that they're going to be competing right against the men's schedule, and matches are going to be played on the same days, nearly at the same time. So yeah, you're going to have issues there, but it's always delightful that you can hear from fans, especially ones that didn't really have much of an interest until their country proved that there really is something to look forward to and something that they're applying for.
Yeah, without question. And it was also interesting to hear from the Dutch fans who really felt that this could potentially push on women's football in the Netherlands. And I think, you know, when you've won a European Championships, you are now the focal point. You know, they will go into the World Cup in 2019 as Europe's best side. And regardless of world rankings, they have just won a major tournament. So that makes them a force to be reckoned with when they go into the tournament in a couple of years' time. A lot of those players still young. You know, Jackie Gronin, 22 years old. Lieke Martins, only mid-20s. Vivian Miedema, 21 years old. You know, they have a hell of a lot of time ahead of them, and they, if they continue to keep building, could be a real force going into 2019 and that World Cup in France. But we've spoken a lot about France and Denmark and the Netherlands, and I want to move on a little bit more, having a look at the tournament as a wider insight. We wanted to try and kind of talk about a few themes, and I think one of the things that is big that we learned in this competition, JJ, is that women's football in Europe is at its most competitive level that we've ever seen. We saw Germany go out of the quarterfinal stage. We saw France go out of the quarterfinal stage. You know, two teams that were really expected to do well. We saw Norway, who are a lot of people's dark horses, go out in the group stage with no goals and no points. This was a tournament, more than any other that we've seen, show that the level of football in Europe is very high and that it's very, very competitive as well.
And I talked about that a little bit earlier, where in past tournaments, especially in 2013, I felt that there was a lot of defensively played football throughout the entirety. Teams that were maybe not as experienced were just prone to, all right, we're going to play 10 behind the ball, have one lone striker up, and you know, if we get any chances, hopefully we'll take them. We didn't see that really in this tournament. We had teams, sure, organized, but they're willing to attack, willing to do whatever it takes to try and win matches. And yeah, you talk about young teams, you talk about the Dutch as being a young team. I look at a team like Austria, who we knew really nothing about prior to this, and you know, their field roster, I think all but two players are south of 26 years old. They could have something to build on for years to come. I know Iceland didn't have a tournament as, you know, a lot of people are maybe anticipating because they've had a lot of momentum built for them, but I think that they still have a lot to prove, and this tournament will not be, you know, something that will define them as a program. It's exciting right now. I know there's a lot of speculation coming in that, well, 16 teams are going to be there. It wasn't the greatest performance in 2013 with 12 teams. You know, what could be done to make it different? I think now Europe isn't even 16 teams deep. They're 20, maybe even 24 teams deep, because obviously with Portugal qualifying, they were many places beyond the next lowest qualifier, and they held their own. So, yeah, this is a great time right now for women's European football.
Yeah, and I actually went on Jen Cooper's podcast, The Mix Zone, which was released this week, and we were talking about the strength and depth of European football. And actually, when you look at the World Cup, this European Championships was 16 teams. 16 teams can't qualify for the World Cup in 2019, so there are going to be some big nations that have performed well in this European Championships that aren't going to be going to France and are not going to have an opportunity to play in a major tournament potentially for another 4 years. And that's quite a scary thought when you think about some of the quality that we saw. And there are going to be some big sides that are going to have to wait their turn because they're not going to be able to go to 2019 World Cup because there just aren't enough spots available. So it is really interesting. And I think what I've noticed is that you will find, and you heard from Daniel van der Donk in the audio earlier, you know, players are now in professional environments at the club level as well, and that is making a hell of a difference. You've now got players like Danielle and like Viviane Miedema who are going to be at Arsenal in a professional environment. You've got players like Lika Martins who is going to be in a professional environment at FC Barcelona. It's going to be big for these players because they are now training every day. They have the best facilities. And that is why European football especially, and I'm not just talking about the Germans or the French, but other nations as well who have players playing in these big leagues, they are developing these individuals. And Daniel van der Donk was quite honest about that.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that one. I think having more opportunities for full-time professionals and players, and you and I talked about it before a little bit off air as well about how some, you know, nations and developing players and the facilities that they have are different. But I was really intrigued to hear that, take Manchester City, for example, where they have a center that's pretty much open throughout the entirety of the day. The team spends pretty much almost the entire day together, day in and day out. A little bit different here in America, but still the point, you know, that it is 10 years ago, we didn't have this for teams. You might have been lucky to have a full-time trainer or maybe a couple of full-time players, but now you have, I mean, how many teams now, you know, you're able to develop younger players, have them hit their peak that maybe the peak only would have been half of that a few years ago. Yeah, it's exciting times.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think one of the other things that I discussed with Jen on her podcast as well was that some of the coaches coming into this competition haven't had an awful lot of time with their teams. And actually, if you're talking about roles as head coach, Serena Wiegman hasn't had that much time as the head coach of the Dutch national team. Granted, she was in the system. She was assistant coach before being promoted. But I look at the likes of Martin Sjögren, 7 months in the job with Norway, Olivier Aschwafny with France, less than a year. Steffi Jones with Germany, less than a year. There are coaches who in 2 years' time, because my understanding is all three of those that I've just mentioned are not going to be in any danger of losing their jobs. They're going to be 2 more years experienced and they're going to be 2 more years having had their ideas enforced on their teams. So you would imagine that those three teams with the talent that they have available will be a lot stronger than they were at Euro 2017. But go on, mate.
Yeah, no, agree. And I think also the motivating factor is teams like that don't like being humbled in major tournaments. I mean, when's the last time we've seen Germany go out of a tournament so early? It would take actually a little bit of research to see that, seeing that they've won the Euros on 8 different occasions prior to it. So not only the fact that you're going to have these coaches be able to spend more time not only enforcing their ideas and trying to figure out the right system and recruiting players, but they want to win. You know, you don't just show up for showing up's sake. They want to succeed. So you bet that not only a performance, well, it won't hurt their jobs, but it's going to light a little fire saying we can't just show up at a tournament anymore and maybe tweak a couple things and we'll be fine. You have to go out there and compete because the next team that's just as hungry, they're going to come out and get you.
Yeah, without question. I think the other thing that was really encouraging, you mentioned the 5 debutants that all got a win. We saw some real underdog performances, didn't we? The likes of Austria getting to the semi-final, we've already mentioned. But, you know, Italy beating Sweden in that group stage match that ended 3-2. I've written a piece for The Equalizer, which it will be up now or certainly will be up soon, sort of naming my 11 moments of the tournament, or certainly 11 talking points of the tournament. And you cannot forget that 3-2 victory that Italy had over Sweden, because for me, that was probably the most fun game of the tournament. And that was an indication of maybe some of the nations that aren't as developed as some of the others, really showing that when they perform and with some of the individuals that they have, Italy's Barbara Bonansea certainly stood out in that game, they can get results against some of the stronger nations.
Yeah, no, I think that match probably was level with the final for the most exciting of the entire tournament. You know, it was a little disappointing for Italy because if they played like that against Russia in the opener, we talked about it on the last podcast, they very well could have knocked out Sweden, one of the giants in this game, in the knockout stage, or excuse me, in the group stage prior to the knockout. So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that one. I think Belgium, you know, we didn't really talk about them a whole lot throughout this tournament, but They've got some world-class players, Janis Kaiman and Tessa Vollaert, who I think that they're going to lead that team into another dimension in the next cycle. I mean, we talked about Austria already, and I mean, can't even forget about the fact that Portugal, as I said earlier, they were the lowest ranked team by far in this tournament. They looked deer-eyed in their first match against Spain, and then they go out and beat Scotland. And I think on another day and a couple of shots don't take deflections or hit the right side of the post, yeah, Portugal might have actually gotten a result against England and get through into the knockout stages. So it's great to see that the underdogs, they weren't just playing for pride, they're playing for points and trying to advance. And obviously we had the great story of Austria getting to the semifinals in their first senior international competition. So I think, yeah, there's a lot to go through. And you look ahead at those World Cup groups for qualifying, mate, a lot of those groups just got a whole lot more challenging than they were maybe 5 months ago.
Yeah, some big contests coming up in those World Cup qualifiers. I'm going to be honest, I haven't got the groups in front of me, but I think if I remember rightly, Norway and Holland are in the same group. So that all of a sudden has got a big contest in the making, with the champions coming up against a team that will be looking to prove a few people wrong. I think we've spoken quite a lot about the final. We've spoken about some key themes that occurred during the competition. Unless there's anything else that you really want to discuss, mate, I think we should look to hand out some awards from the competition.
Let's dole out some prizes.
Okay, so I want to focus first on the team of the tournament. Now, the team of the tournament was named the day after the competition had finished. There weren't many surprises in there, but I want to see if your team is any different. Now, the team that was named was a 4-4-2. You said, I don't like 4-4-2, I like 3-5-2. So I'm going to give you the license to go over 3-5-2. But let's reel off the team that UEFA named. They went with Sari van Veenendaal in goal. They went with a back four of Lucy Bronze, Anouk Dekker, Steph Horton of England, and Vereen Ashwar of Austria. They went with Theresa Nielsen, Jackie Gronin, Sherida Spitzer and Lika Martins in midfield. And then Pernilla Harder and Jodie Taylor as the forwards. So if we're going to go a little bit different, we're going to go 3-5-2. So first of all, who's your goalkeeper?
I am going to make one slight change to Sari. I thought that she was very, very good. But I thought Manuela Zinsberger of Austria probably just edges her on that front.
I agree with you. I think they conceded one. She conceded one goal in 510 minutes of football, and she saved some penalties in the quarterfinal victory over Spain in the shootout as well. So she gets the nod from me. Who's your back three?
Now, see, the back three is a little bit intriguing for me because it's tough to eliminate any of those four. I thought out of that group, I thought Dekker will be, that was the toughest to let go. So she stays. I think Steph Houghton stays. But then here's the one that scratches my head, Kieran. Maybe you and I could, or at least you could shed a little more light to this. Theresa Nielsen of Denmark is listed as a defender, but they put her in the midfield and she played a little bit of both. So for me, that kind of opens up the gap to maybe push her into the back and take out Lucy Bronze and Vereen Ashwar from Austria. Can you mind clarifying a little bit of that for me?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Katia Krageland, who obviously writes for us, who's from Denmark, said that exact same thing when the team came out. Theresa Nielsen, not really known as a defensive midfielder, plays more as an outside player, and you could easily put her in that back. I mean, she's not really a centre back, so, but then, you know, Lucy Bronze isn't a centre back now either. So if you were going to have her in the back three, there's no reason why you couldn't have Theresa Nielsen. So you're going Anouk Dekker, you're going Steph Horton, then you're going Theresa Nielsen?
That's correct. And I think a real honourable mention should be Millie Bright. I know you were high on her throughout the entire tournament, and I thought she was very good for England in five matches.
Well, she goes in for me. I'm going to be honest. I thought she was better than Steph Horton. I think Vereen Ashwar was excellent. I really do. She'd probably just miss out for me. I'm going to go heavily biased on England with the back three. I'm going to go with Lucy Bronze, Millie Bright, and I'm going to go with you as well. I'm going to go Anouk Dekker. So that would be my back three. Who you got in midfield? You got to probably look at a holding midfielder first.
Oh, holding midfielder first. Okay, hold on. Wow, I kind of got jumped on there a little bit. I was just going to name five straight off the jump.
Well, go for it. It doesn't have to be a holding midfielder. Go with five off the bounce.
All right, so here we go. So I'm making a couple of changes here. First off, I know Pernille Harder is both a striker as well as a midfielder. At times she could flex a little bit, both maybe sit in underneath. So I'm, just for my sake, I'm pushing her back into the midfield group. So she goes in there. Unfortunately, and I'm going to probably get a lot of flack for this, but you know what? I don't really care. This is for talking points. Sherita Spitzel was brilliant in this tournament, but two of her goals were from the spot, and she hit that great free kick in the final. But I think just for this point, I'm just going to remove her slightly for right now. So Harder goes in the midfield with Jackie Gronin. I think that's without a question. Lika Martins, without a question. I think Shanice van de Sanden, how she got left out of this original team, is an absolute joke to me. So she gets put in. Then the fifth one was really a toss-up because I think there are three players that you could easily have in there. Along with Spitzer, you could have had Firesinger from Austria, who I thought was brilliant this entire tournament. I still think Lotta Schelin was very, very good for Sweden. At times, she was the player that was carrying the load. And then for her fantastic performance in three group stage matches, I think that Barbara Bonansea should have been in there as well. So if you're asking me to pick one, I will be putting this one on my head and going with Shailene. So it'll be the midfield five of Harder, Martins, Gronin, van de Sanden, and I think that was it, right?
And yeah, Lotta Schelin, who for me plays more as a striker. But you know, this is your team of the tournament. You can do what you want, mate. You know, you could stick Manuela Zenzerberger up front if you really wanted to. It's entirely up to you. Well, mine's going to be different. I'm sticking with Sherida Spitzer. I think you cannot have the play that Jackie Gronin and Daniela van der Donk had unless you have that protection behind you. And I think Sherida Spitzer was the best holding midfielder in the competition. I am with you on Jackie Gronin. Anyone who would leave her out of the team of the tournament hasn't really watched the tournament and they're lying to themselves. Lika Martin stays in there as well. So that obviously makes three midfielders from the Netherlands. I would, like you, I would put Pernille Harder as my kind of attacking midfielder in behind the front two. And I am going to go with Laura Firesinger as my other midfielder. I thought she was absolutely superb. She ran and covered every blade of grass in the games that she played. She didn't miss a single minute. She played extra time in both games, was never substituted at any point. And I thought, for a player that maybe wasn't being spoken about that much before the competition, I thought she was superb. And I think one other player that I'd like to mention who sadly misses out is Jordan Nobbs. I thought she was superb for England. I think she is the future of that team and the player that Mark Sampson needs to build the side around. But she just misses out for me. She'd probably be the one player that I would like to squeeze in there, but actually can't find any room for her. So yes, my midfield would be Lika Martins, Sherida Spitzer, Jackie Gronin, Laura Firesinger, and Pernille Harder. And the front two, mate?
Jodie Taylor and Viviana Diemba. I mean, you know, it was funny because after the group stage, you said number nines had had a horrible tournament up to this point. I think Midima, she very, very good for club, very good for country in non-major tournament matches. But boy, when she got one, the rest came because she was brilliant in the knockout stage. In addition to her play in the group stage where she was the hold-up striker, she opened up a lot of avenues for a lot of other players. So I think she gets it. And I mean, you can't have a player who scores a hat trick in the first match and finishes off as the Golden Boot winner not be in your top 11. So Jodie Taylor and Midima will be my two.
Yeah, same with me. Nothing to disagree with there. I think, you know, Midima maybe didn't score the goals in the group stages, but she played very well. Her movement was great. She brought in Lika Martins and Shanice van der Sanden into the game. And then when it really mattered in the knockout phases, she scored in the three knockout games, managed to get four goals in those three matches, and finished just behind Jodie Taylor for the Golden Boot. She showed up big time when it really mattered, and she showed what a talent she is, and she showed what a huge future she's got, because at the age of 21, it's actually frightening to think that she's still got over 10 years left at the top of the game. And Jodie Taylor, few will have expected her to do as well as she did. We know Jodie Taylor is class. One of the biggest issues for Jodie has been keeping fit and avoiding injuries. She managed to avoid injury in this competition, and she showed up big time. You know, she led the line superbly. It was through no fault of her own that she wasn't able to influence the game in the semi-final against the Netherlands, because it was just simply aimless balls over the top, trying to catch her over the top against the Dutch defenders, and they dealt with it very, very easily, and there was very little plan B from Mark Sampson, and ultimately that's why England have been knocked out. So that is our teams of the tournament. Who was your overall player of the competition, JJ?
Well, again, I think it's the odd one, because which of the midfielders for the Netherlands can you pick from? Because I think you have a legitimate shout for all four of them. Yeah, but sometimes at the end of the day, the statistics will overpower everything else. So I think Leek and Martens, with their three goals and pair of assists and probably at her hand and a half dozen other goals, yeah, she will be unchanged from what the tournament announced, and I'll be giving her my player of the tournament, though I think Jackie Groenen was probably a very, very close runner-up.
Yeah, if you can split the award in two, then you'd give it to Martens and Groenen. It was interesting. I've just written a piece for 442 USA kind of outlining five players that I think would fit well in the NWSL, and Groenen was one of them. And she was actually described by Pierre van Hooijdonk, who is a former Dutch international and was the ambassador for the Women's Euros. He described her as our women's team's Iniesta, and I think that's a perfect comparison. I'm not fond, I'll be honest, of comparing the women's players to the men's players. We see it quite often with Frank Kirby being described as the mini Messi of the England team, but if you are going to compare Groenen to a men's international, then Iniesta is about as close as you're going to get, because she was absolutely superb in those games that she played and was the real link between defence and attack. So I think she's a very, very close second. But I'm like you. I think Leeka Martens would be the player that wins it for me. What was your favourite game of the competition?
Man, that's tough. I mean, we've said obviously the final, fantastic. The Italy comeback over Sweden, fantastic. I think you can almost kind of say any one of Austria's positive results could have been one of them. But yeah, you know what? I'm just going to stick with the not so much of the obvious choice, but I think the one that just will always stand out at the end of the day, which will be the final. I think it was just a fantastic atmosphere. You experienced it firsthand. I wish I was there, but to see all the images, all the videos on social media come through afterwards, and I think having that carry over to that massive, massive celebration that they had for the Netherlands, which on the day of recording happened, I think, what, a couple hours earlier prior to it. Man, that was fun.
Yeah, huge celebrations in Utrecht where the team opened the competition. You know, people lining the streets, thousands upon thousands of people, you know, celebrating their women's team. And it was really encouraging to see. I find it difficult to disagree. And actually, it's really nice to be able to say that a final was the game of the tournament, because how many times do we watch finals in both the men's and sometimes the women's game where the final just flatters to deceive and actually is really disappointing, because you've got two teams who are more concerned by not losing than they are about going out to win the game. So the final for me, incredible atmosphere, lots of goals, lots of quality on show. It was a massive shame that someone had to lose it. Unfortunately, on the day it was Denmark, but as I say, to see a team win their competition in their home nation was really, really special, because you get an idea of the momentum building. You get to see firsthand local people getting on board and really showing their support. And that final was the final that people in Holland deserved. And they were by far the best team over the course of the competition. So I'm with you on that one, mate. The final for me was the best game of the tournament. But we'll wrap up the Euros there, mate. I just want to spend a few minutes very quickly talking about the Tournament of Nations. Obviously, we've talked about a major competition that happens every 4 years. We can't make any comparison between the Tournament of Nations and the Euros. But it's an important competition for the teams that are involved, because it's all about preparation for bigger things for the United States. You know, it's about looking forward to the World Cup in 2019. Australia have Asia Cup competition next year, and of course, Japan as well. And they were joined by Brazil You saw more of it than I did because of the time difference. Australia came out on top with three very, very good victories. What would you say were the major talking points from the Tournament of Nations?
Well, I think for me, we'll start with Australia and the fact that, you know, this was a plan that was set back out in 2011 where Tom Cermani plays a team in the World Cup made up of mostly teenagers. Now they're all in their mid-20s. They're experienced professionals. And, you know, this is a tournament that had the number one team in the world, the United States, team six, team seven, team eight in Brazil, Australia, and Japan. And Australia, their offense was just flying. And, I mean, obviously a lot of their players are playing either in the United States or they're just getting ready to start their competitive season with Germany. So it's not like this was a preseason-ish tournament for them or a warm-up for club competition, but a lot of these players were in fine form. And boy, it seemed like everything that they were doing right going forward, they made it work, because you can't say that it wasn't successful if you bagged 11 goals against three nations in the top eight in the world.
Yeah, 4-2 over Japan, 1-0 over the United States, 6-1 over Brazil. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in terms of a Brazil performance. But answer me this. We've talked about the likes of Viviana Miedema, Jodie Taylor, Pernilla Harder. Is there a better striker in the world at the moment than Sam Kerr?
If they were to give the FIFA World Player of the Year for the first 7 months of 2017, I think Sam Kerr wins it going away. I mean, it is scary to think how locked in she is. And a couple of episodes ago, if you all want to listen back to the chat that I had with Sam, she's having fun again. And I think that's a big part of what, you know, was the change from a couple of years ago. Not to say that she wasn't having fun, but injuries were a problem, and, you know, maybe getting a little too focused on trying to develop and push a little bit, that might have hurt her in the short term. But she's having fun, and when a striker is having fun, usually that means the goals are coming along with it. So yeah, whether it's for club, multiple clubs, or whether it's for country, I think right now she's the best striker on the planet.
Yeah, and ably supported by some of the talent around her, isn't she? Caitlin Ford was, again, impressive. You look at that midfield. For me, Elise Kellen-Knight is always a consistent performer for that team. The back line, I know, speaking to Anne O'Dong, who obviously I've got to say a huge thank you to for some of the Euro coverage that she did, and obviously to yourself as well, mate. But speaking to Anne, I know the defence is probably the one area that they're not exactly weak in, but I think Alan Stajic, the head coach, is still trying to figure out which his best back line is, because he does rotate that position a little bit more often than he does elsewhere. But they just have so much depth now. They have players that they can bring off the bench who will make a difference. And, you know, they look the real deal at the moment. It was only a friendly tournament, but you can only beat the opposition that's put in front of you. But the Australians are absolutely flying. You're right. If Sam Kerr doesn't win the Ballon d'Or, if it were offered tomorrow, then that would be a travesty. If she continues the way she is, she's going to be in contention without a doubt. Let's talk about your team, the United States. More experimenting from Jill Ellis. What do you make of them? Obviously had the defeat against Australia, but then two positive results in the next games. What's your assessment of them?
I mean, that's kind of a performance, and I know there's plenty of people out there that have kind of beaten this to a pulp, and I'm not really one of those people. I kind of look at the bigger picture right now. You take what you can from this tournament. Again, as you said, it's a friendly tournament. You play against the teams that are there, but there's no real, well, there is an actual trophy, but there's, you know, players, would they rather trade an Olympic gold or a World Cup championship medal for this? Absolutely. But, you know, that first 70 minutes against Brazil kicked them in the pants in the right way, because then they lit a fire throughout the rest of the tournament. You know, they obviously came back, scored three inside of 12 minutes to beat Brazil. And then I think that's a performance against Japan, one that we haven't seen from that U.S. team in quite a long time, handling a very good team and doing it in the way that they did. I think that will be, if they can mimic that result and help them push on towards World Cup qualifying. Now, granted, again, it's a big grain of salt, because obviously you have Canada and Mexico and Costa Rica, the, you know, the group of four that are always going to be there. And then you have the other four teams that usually round out the competition. You you don't have to say you only show up for those matches, but you could take, you know, those match, the other matches with a little lighter grain of salt. But if they can mimic what they did against Japan through the next 12 months or so, Jill Ellis has said the tinkering has pretty much stopped for her for the most part after this competition. She knows or has a pretty good idea of what her group is going to be and what type of team that she'll be putting onto the field each match. If they can do that, then I think that they're going to be in okay shape.
So if that's the case, does that mean that the likes of Danielle Colaprico, Vanessa DiBernardo, players that we've mentioned continuously on this show, are not going to have a chance of getting in? I mean, I didn't see the game, but I understand that Jill experimented with Becky Sauerbrunn as a holding midfielder. Now, for me, I saw a really good piece by Richard Farley on 442 USA recently on how McCall Zaborni has done really well this season for the North Carolina Courage. And I completely echo what he said. You know, one of the best, for me, midfielders in the NWSL this season. Why would you trial Becky Sauerbrunn, probably the best centre-back in the world, at defensive mid when you have a whole host of midfielders knocking on the door trying to get into that team?
And I think the popular answer is here is we'd all love to know why Jill Ellis isn't calling in players like them. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have players that you feel more comfortable about on the field, regardless of position, than some other players that you would. But, yeah, I'd love to know the same answer myself personally, because I think McCall Zaborni throughout her career, and she's actually been playing for quite a while now. She was one of the originals in 2009 of WPS, and she has played every year pretty much, I think maybe minus the end of 2015 into the beginning of 2016. That was a little bit challenging for her at times, but I think she's been one of those great players that should have gotten a look on multiple occasions. I think, why in the world is Erin Gilliland still not being called into the team? Why is Colaprico all of a sudden and DiBernardo not getting looks at? But then Sofia Huerta, who has had a very good season, were the U.S. is all of a sudden trying to rush her and try and get her allegiance to be switched again. Yeah, these are questions I'd love to know, but unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to find out. So, yeah, to answer your question bluntly, I guess that's going to be the end of it, unless there are a lot of injuries that happen between now and next October, whenever the World Cup qualifying tournament is.
Yeah, it's not just Jill Ellis that does it. I'm not looking to pick on Jill. I know that there are some people who are not a fan of her. I am indifferent. I'm not for or against her. I'm very much neutral, but you just see a lot of coaches at the moment. It's very much square pegs, round holes. I mean, I don't know what the kind of thinking is, but I know John Halloran, who is part of the NWSL Media Association and does some good work and is based in Chicago. I think he tweeted out during the tournament that they were using Sofia Huerta in training as an outside back. And you know, this is a player who has been doing phenomenal things for the Red Stars as an attacking player. And why would you look to trial her in a position that she's completely unfamiliar with when you have, like you said, her teammate Erin Gilliland, who plays that position every week? We saw Taylor Smith do it very well during the competition as well. Play your best players in their best positions. Becky Sauerbrunn is not a holding midfielder. Julie Ertz is a holding midfielder. If you want to put her there, then put her there. And she's done actually very well as a number 10 this season as well. So we're getting into very technical areas here, and I don't want to bore the listeners, but it's just something that I find incredibly frustrating. It's not just Jill Ellis that does it. I see coaches, so many areas that are playing players out of position. And I'm not a coach, so maybe what we need to do is get one on and maybe get some insight as to why they do that. In fact, we will do that. Let's get a coach on and find out why they decide to play players out of position. Because for me, if you want the best results, you play your best players in the best positions. But, you know, that's my opinion on the situation, and I'd be interested to know, you know, what a coach has to say about it. But, I mean, the tournament's made up of four teams, mate, Brazil and Japan. I don't really have a lot to say on them because I didn't see a huge amount, but they are two teams very much in transition at the moment, aren't they? They are looking to build ahead of 2019. Japan have lost some very experienced players over the last few years. Brazil had a few players missing from the tournament for one reason or another. Didn't overly impress. The, you know, Brazil threw away the lead against the US and then completely flopped against Australia. Japan, lots of young players. We know what you're going to get with them. Technically very good on the ball. They are, I think they're exactly what Spain are trying to be. They have a lot of possession, but they have the end ball at the end of the sequence, whereas Spain, lots of possession in the Euros, didn't have that final ball that was going to cut defences open. But I don't know if you have anything to add on those two.
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it right on the head. Australia and US, not to say that the four teams as a collective didn't play their A teams, but you know that Brazil had a couple of key ingredients missing. So, yeah, I take every result that they had with a big old grain of salt. And then Japan, I mean, they're pretty much, you know, with their new head coach in, they've seen huge transition. A lot of their traditional veterans that could very well still be playing are not playing for the country anymore. It's gone to pretty much an extended under 23 side at the moment. So, yeah, I think they're not rebuilding, they're just rebranding a little bit, and I wouldn't be shocked to see them as at least a quarterfinalist in the next the next World Cup, and probably a challenge to win the Asian Cup again. But yeah, I think you had it right. It's just, this is a tournament to allow players to get experience against good teams in a very low pressure environment. So, you know, we'll kind of just leave it at that for both those two.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting tournament. Congratulations to Australia. Absolutely superb. We'll have to see how they continue to progress. JJ, I think we'll wrap it up there, mate. We've been going for a little while. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you very much for the support on the Euros coverage. Same also to, I've got to give a shout out to Anno Dong, did a huge amount of work and was getting up at God knows what hour of the morning in Australia. And also to Katia Craigland and Linda Eriksson, who work with us. They did some of the social media during the tournament. Thank you so much to listeners as well, and those that are engaging with us on Twitter. We saw huge, huge engagement and interest in what we were pushing out. So thank you so much for taking an interest in what we were doing. There's a lot of outlets now who cover women's football and women's soccer, and you know, we appreciate the support that you've given us over the last few months especially. So thank you to you. Of course, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do. We're on Twitter, on at WosoZone. You can email us on wosozone@gmail.com, and of course there's always content going up at womenssoccerzone.com. Podcasts are there, features are there, columns are there. We'll have some more columns coming up in the future. So thank you very much. Until the next time, take care of yourselves, and bye-bye.